Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
I have to tell you, I got so many texts and emails, I think over a dozen, from friends and patients in the last 24 hours asking me about vaccines. I'm going to give you a sample here. Dear Dr. Motika, hope you and Charlie are doing well. We're staying healthy so far. I wonder if you have further views on the vaccine. I heard negative things about what is in it, and I'm curious if you've heard anything about their using nanotechnology. I was sent a lengthy link by one of my mom's caregivers, wondering if you had heard anything. Thanks for your thoughts. And that was from Barbara. And Barbara, we will get into that in just a few moments, but we're going to start with the satellite view and just kind of define a virus, okay? It's really important to understand this. A virus is like a seed. It doesn't eat, it doesn't move, it doesn't defend itself. It's basically just a program in a box. Like the discs I used to get in the mail from America Online once a week back in the day. A virus is not alive. It's a piece of infectious information looking for a platform on which to run. That's why they call them computer viruses, my friend. Well, we're talking about people or animal viruses or even viruses that attack bacteria. Yes, that's a thing. The virus has one job. Its job is to replicate itself and send out more copies to invade more cells and make more copies. It's a package with just two little components, genetic material with the code or blueprint for making itself, and a protein casing to protect that genetic information. The casings have a little grappling hook for their target living cells, and there are plant viruses as well. But the point is, the virus is attacking something that has DNA, and therefore has a factory for making more DNA, as well as making more protein. It needs to hijack that factory. That casing also has, well, something that's like a little syringe with a needle on it that it uses to push itself inside the cell. Once inside, it hijacks that cell's protein factory and gets busy making copies of itself, unfortunately destroying the cell in the process. Remember I said what's inside that casing is information, genetic information. And there are two kinds of viruses, DNA viruses and RNA viruses, and also retroviruses, but let's not get too complicated. So DNA, most of us are pretty familiar with. It is a double-stranded line of chemicals that twists upon itself in a spiral. That spiral gives it structural stability. In fact, DNA is really stable. You can dig DNA out of a frozen mammoth, maybe even out of an insect trapped in amber, a la Jurassic Park, and probably get viable information. It may be a little distorted, a little messed up, oh well, but it's still pretty amazing how long DNA lasts and how durable it is. All that saliva on your coffee cup, right? So RNA is quite different. Now, where does RNA come in? Well, let's go through what happens with DNA to help us understand. The DNA is contained in the case of humans, one of your 46 chromosomes. You have two copies of everything, one copy from mom, one copy from dad. When you want to make some protein, you unroll a piece of your DNA and you make a transcription. That transcription is made of RNA, messenger RNA, in fact. And the messenger RNA contains a direct transcript of the gene. It isn't perfect. There's a lot of post-transcriptional editing that goes on. Turns out RNA is way more complicated than we thought. And we've talked a little bit about micro-interfering RNA and other subjects on this program. But back to the basics. That RNA, once transcribed, leaves the cell and goes into the area outside the nucleus called the cytoplasm. At that point, the RNA looks for a ribosome. Ribosomes are like clamshells. They are these clamshell-shaped components of protein, and they open up. The messenger RNA starts to move across, kind of like that old-fashioned stock ticker tape that you see in the old Charlie Chaplin movies. In the middle of that ribosome, taking proteins, or rather amino acids, and putting them on a chain. So essentially, the way you build that protein is you build a chain of amino acids directed to do so by the messenger RNA. RNA is probably what came first back in the day before there was actually cellular life on the planet. But RNA is very fragile. Doesn't really make good life forms. Viruses figured out how to do it by building that protective shell that protects their RNA. This explains one of the problems with these viral vaccines that we're going to be talking about now. And as I said, I'm going to come back to the nano in a moment. First, let's talk about which vaccines there are, what they are, and how they differ. Now, we've all been hearing a lot lately about the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine because these are, well, at least in the United States, first to the table, so to speak. And they are similar in that they are both lipid-encapsulated mRNA. So they're covered with a very small lipid that allows them to fuse into the cells. And that's important. So it's basically, you've probably seen cosmetics or other things that are called liposomal. They're basically in a fat bubble. This is like a liposome. But because of terminology, people think, oh my God, they're going all nano on us. Ah! No. So let's relax about the nano. Let's just talk about, you've got a fat bubble, you've got viral RNA, messenger RNA, to make the spike protein, but not the rest of the virus. So it gets in there, it finds itself a ribosome, it starts being made. And I'm not really quite clear on how it ends up getting outside of the cell so that the immune system could see it. And I have tried to figure that out and tried to read the science, but, you know, it is so dense and difficult that I'm even getting lost in the weeds, and it takes a lot. They have to be pretty high weeds. These are pretty high weeds. So getting back to the differences between the two vaccines, the vaccine that's the Pfizer is the one that got the press a couple of weeks ago, and it was initially 90% effective, and then later on they said, oh, well, no, actually it's 95% effective. But this one is RNA, and it's not temperature stabilized. So they made an RNA vaccine, but it has to be kept at minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit, which is really difficult. What we think is happening is that they're going to ship it. It's 975 vials. Each vial has 5 doses. They're shipped on dry ice, and you can let them thaw out and keep them in the refrigerator for about 5 or 6 days. But that's it. Then they go bad and you're back to square one. Your 4,000 odd doses are lost. So we don't want to let that happen. You can keep refilling the container it comes in with dry ice. You can put it in a refrigerator that will get down to minus 94 Fahrenheit. There is a supply chain issue at the moment for these otherwise not high demand items, as you might imagine. That's Pfizer. Now, let's contrast that with the Moderna vaccine, also a lipid nanoparticle encapsulated messenger RNA, but somehow this one doesn't need to be kept as cold. It can be stored in a regular freezer. This is fascinating to me, and I am assuming that the reason Moderna got the contract, so to speak, is because they have a stabilization methodology that is a proprietary secret that is allowing them to build a different vaccine, a vaccine that can be transported and kept frozen as vaccines ordinarily are. So this is a really big plus. It also lasts longer once reconstituted, so this is going to be helpful. The Pfizer vaccine, once you put salt water in it and start giving it, oh, by the way, did I mention there's 5 doses per vial? So you got an odd number of doses in there. That's maybe not so big a problem if you're doing industrial vaccination, big long line of people, hospital settings, going into, let's say, nursing homes, charging in there with 150 doses, getting all the staff, getting all the people. So I think the Pfizer one's coming out early. It's going to be a pain in the butt to use. But because we're going to be doing targeted vaccination of high-risk groups, it's a pretty decent product. Plus, we're going to have it. The Moderna vaccine doesn't have quite the industrial production capability. They'll probably get there. It will be interesting to see how it plays out. But my thoughts are that big outfits, centralized distributors, will be able to use the Pfizer vaccine, and smaller outfits, my little medical practice, for example, would only get the Moderna or one of the other vaccines. Now, there was big news today on the vaccine front. AstraZeneca vaccine, this is the Oxford University AstraZeneca vaccine, has had yet another setback. There's weirdness around their research. Meanwhile, another setback for them, the British government just approved the Pfizer vaccine. The initial results that came out a couple of weeks ago, this vaccine, the Oxford AstraZeneca, was found to be 70% effective in a preliminary analysis. And this is really one of those funny science serendipity studies. Somebody messed up on the protocol. So in one subgroup that was doing the vaccine, the first shot they gave was actually half the dose. They made a mistake and they gave a lower amount of vaccine in the first dose than they were supposed to. Everybody else gave the full dose, the appropriate amount. But the people at that location who got the lower amount of vaccine in the first dose and then the correct amount of vaccine in the second dose had a 90% effectiveness, whereas overall, the group that got it correctly, the two full doses a month apart, got a 62% effective. So when you added them together, you got 70. Actually can make sense, according to immunologist Katie Ewer. A lower dose of vaccine might actually do a better job of stimulating a subset of the immune cells called T cells. So too much might sort of flood the T cells, apparently, and you wouldn't get as vigorous a response. And it's the T cells that then go on to teach the B cells to make antibody. So that could be it. Another thing particular to this vaccine, the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, is that this is not a messenger RNA vaccine. This is made from a weakened virus. So this is a live virus vaccine made from weakened virus, very similar to the old oral polio. You make a virus that's too weak to really make people sick. And we have a few live virus vaccines, measles, mumps, rubella, for example. They work very well. So I like this vaccine for one reason and one reason only. I like that the vehicle is one we already know about. Now, the Chinese are working with an adenovirus vector vaccine. They have actually two vaccines that are in phase 3 trials, one called CanSino. This is just a cold virus. And then there's another one that's an inactivated SARS-CoV-2, and that's in phase 3. So this is a dead virus vaccine. It's an inactivated virus. It's dead. This is inactivated SARS-CoV-2. That means you have to grow a lot of SARS-CoV-2 to get your vaccine supply. So that creates some challenges. There's a couple of other vaccines in phase 2 that I'm not going to go into except to say one of these truly is a nanoparticle, not just nanolipid encoding the virus to create a sort of fake cell, but instead an actual nanoparticle that is essentially copies of the spike protein dotted onto a core. And this is fascinating science, and I have to read through the article. I'll be back next week or the week after when I've waded through it, just to talk about how cool this is and how great the potential is for our ability to put together a vaccine rapidly to fight any disease that's coming at us. So in the long run, I want to just emphasize that we have seen a major bump in our disease-fighting technology. It's the silver lining of the COVID cloud. We're going to be a lot better at building platforms rapidly and shaping them to the situation. These are all very cool bits of information that should make us take a deep breath and feel a little bit better about what 2021 is going to look like. I'm not trying to simplify it. It's not going to be simple, but I am feeling guardedly optimistic about the future, so it's all for the good. Okay, so let's go to the first of two emails I got this week from Shaul, a longtime listener, all the way over in Israel. And Shaul writes, regarding masks, is there a mask which gives good protection against coronavirus in both directions? Yes, Shaul, there is. And that is the one that doctors wear. It's called an N, as in Nancy, N95. And unfortunately, the price for N95 masks has gone up tenfold since February, which makes me sad and annoyed. But that's what happens when you get competition. It's called the market price. And depending upon the demand, the market price tends to vary. Global capitalism is based on this. It is a emergent kind of complex dynamic system, but it seems to actually work better than when you try to anticipate what's going to happen and adapt to it from the top down, at least as the various experiments in communism or other planned economies have shown us. It'd be interesting to see what happens when our robot masters are using machine intelligence to plan our economy. But that experiment is yet to be tried, so I will keep an open mind until it happens. Our next email comes from Mardine. Hi, Dr. Dawn. This question may apply to a lot of people, so I hope you will address it on your show. I have shifted my diet toward paleo by dramatically reducing the number of simple carbs I consume, including breads, rice, potatoes, pastas, processed foods, and sugars. I also increased fermented foods and prebiotic fiber, including kombucha, jicama, kimchi, sauerkraut, and pickled veggies. I make most of my own meals, subscribing to Sunbasket with a focus on paleo low-carb recipes. I've been feeling well and growing lighter and healthier, but there's a downside to my dietary changes as well. My husband has a very sensitive nose, and he notices a change in my body odor since I have changed my diet. He says it fills the room, making it hard to be near me and often keeps him up at night. I've tried avoiding garlic and onions, and we've searched for other foods that might cause bad body odor. One of the articles that we read suggests that ketones may be a culprit. I don't know if I've actually succeeded in achieving ketosis, but it's certainly a goal that I'm striving for. I hope that there's a way that I can reach my dietary and health goals without driving my husband into a separate bedroom. Have you heard about this problem from others, and do you have any suggestions for finding a solution? So here we are, a person who is going paleo, having difficulty. It almost sounds like an Ann Landers or a Dear Abby, but actually there's some science behind that. Now, it's something that I've heard a lot from vegetarians, that they can smell carnivores. And diet definitely does affect body odors. I was looking this up, trying to find some core research, and one researcher gave a really interesting thing. Body odors of women become unpleasant when they watch horror movies. Okay, so I'm assuming those are fear pheromones, but we can, in fact, detect things we can't smell. There's an organ in your nose called the vomerular organ, And it reads pheromones. So these are non-odorous odors, if you will. They don't register to our olfactory bulbs, and they are the sort of things that, like moths use for homing. And, you know, insects are very big on pheromones, and they also influence, they act like hormones to influence development of many insects. So this is interesting stuff, but let's get back to Mardine's question. About 14 years ago, researchers at Charles University in Prague tested the hypothesis that diet affects body odor. They had men give up meat for 2 weeks. It's hard to study body odor, so they decided to use a special kind of design. They compared each subject's body odor before and after they went on the vegetarian or the, let's call it the no meat and the meat group. The ones that gave up red meat for 2 weeks, then started eating meat for 2 weeks, and the other group in the opposite order. They also had to stay off alcohol and other drugs. They had to eat the same foods. They were given a list of 33 meatless meals to choose from. And then during the other meat weeks, they had the same entree, but with the addition of meat. So like pork risotto instead of vegetarian risotto. So they really tried to design a good study. Body odors were collected by having people wear cotton pads in their armpits for 24 hours. They then placed them in jars and had 30 different female students sniff them and rate the smell on a 7-point scale for intensity, pleasantness, sexual attractiveness, and masculinity. So it turned out that the women found the vegetarians, the meatless diet, much better. Pleasantness went from 3.7 to 4. Sexual attractiveness went from 3.5 to 3.8. Intensity dropped from 4.5 to 4. So, your sweat smells more intense if you eat meat. And it isn't quite as attractive to the ladies, and presumably in the opposite direction as well. Another thing was interesting about this study, actually it leads to another study, but they also found that the men's skin got yellower. So another group in Australia decided to have people consume smoothies that were laced with orange vegetables like carrots for 6 weeks. And then they looked at their skin tone and found that it did shift towards the yellow. The idea was, well, maybe it's the carotenoids that are coming out in the sweat that the women are smelling. This study was done in Australia, but when they did that, what they found was quite a surprise. It didn't replicate. The Australian women rated the body odors of frequent meat eaters to be more pleasant than men who ate a lot of vegetables. So the first story is in Czechoslovakia, where they probably eat less meat, quite honestly. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Somebody who's lived in both Australia and Czechoslovakia, if such a person exists, shoot me a line and let me know. However, it certainly makes sense, Mardine, that this could be happening to you. So what are we going to do about this? Well, my first thought, since it is that he's got a very sensitive smell and he's picking up whatever this is, and whether it's ketones or some other component of meat is kind of irrelevant to thinking of the solution. I was curious about whether having you take a hot bath before bedtime would make a difference, and essentially sweating out a fair amount of the compound and then rinsing off and seeing if that helped with the evening. The other thing that you could think about doing would be some kind of masking product. I think that probably what you want to do first is just eat your paleo foods, but eat more vegetables. Vegetables like greens because of the chlorophyll. So I'm thinking maybe the cure for this is a green smoothie every morning, or maybe more, even more than that. But you could definitely do the experiment and with both of these two interventions and see if either of them helps. It's an extremely interesting problem. And if there are any other mixed marriages, that is to say, paleo vegans out there, it would be really interesting. If I were a psychology professor, I'd really look at divorce rates and people switching to paleo diets. And also, just does it have an effect on your ability to find a partner of the opposite? Or they just don't smell right. So no, forget it. Totally fascinating. I have twice in my life, when I was much younger, had boyfriends who did not smell right. But I was always eating meat back then, so I never did figure out what that was all about. So let's go back to Shaul, and Shaul had a second question. He's a man of few words. His questions are always very brief. Dear Dr. Don, tapping. I see applications and an article about the benefits of tapping. Any truth in it? And yes, actually, there's a fair amount of truth in this. This is something called the emotional freedom technique, and it's a therapeutic method. It sounds wacky when you first hear about it, but I found a study where they actually measured the physiological effect. First of all, let's define our terms. Emotional freedom technique is an intervention. It was invented to combine a bunch of different elements, so it's good for phobias, for example. It's good for anxiety. They combine elements of exposure therapy, which is where you, if you're afraid of driving across a bridge, you expose yourself to bridges and get closer and closer and then finally get in the car and sit on the bridge and then drive across. Cognitive therapy, which is where you try to learn to think about something differently by reframing it or changing the way you assign meaning to it, recognizing maybe that you're assigning too much meaning to the fact that somebody didn't make eye contact with you. And somatic stimulation of acupressure points on the face and body. And people identify an issue they wish to address, and then they set up a statement, and they say, okay, this is how, 1 to 10, this is how much I hate it. It makes me angry. This is the nature of my distress. Then they say to themselves something along the line of, even though I have this problem, I completely accept myself. Then they engage in a somatic tapping process. So they tap on acupuncture points on their face and body while they repeat a short phrase to stay engaged. Like if they're angry about something, they repeat, I feel angry about this. And as they tap themselves, they stop and they check in and they say, okay, do I still hate it at a 10 or do I now hate it at a 3? How bad is it still making me feel? It's called the subjective unit of distress. And there are many, many studies that show that this actually works. There's actually a review of 31 different studies and showed that it was very helpful in both anxiety and depression. This study that I'm quoting had people go to a workshop, but they also found that people's resting heart rate dropped, their blood pressure dropped, measurable things, trends in heart rate variability. All of these got better with a very short therapy. Their happiness scores got better. Their pain got better. Their secretory IgA, that's the antibody in your snot that protects you from colds, that got higher. In fact, that went up, it doubled. So really amazing. And I'm very glad that you asked that question, Shaul, because I'm going to need to learn this. This thing is bloody cool and very portable. So we'll move to our first caller, and that is Roseanne in New Jersey. Hello, Roseanne.
Good evening, Dr. Dawn. So one of your radio shows, you mentioned that you leave your windows open to, I guess, allow the virus to go out and bring fresh air in. And
that's
a friend
right.
And I were discussing that today, and we were saying, well, if the windows are open, how do we know the virus isn't going to come in to that window? Where is the virus? Is it on the grass? Is it on the trees? Is it in the air? Does anybody know where the virus actually is?
Yes. So let me start with a metaphor for you, okay? Now, I want you to imagine that you have a glass of water, and I want you to imagine taking one little grain of salt and dropping it into that glass of water and stirring it up so you can't see the salt anymore. Do you think you could taste that one grain of salt?
Probably
not. Because it's too diluted. So The answer to the outside air versus the inside air is exactly that. The outside air is diluted. And so it's if the air is moving, what's going to happen is that the air coming in is going to reduce the concentration, like adding, like diluting down a soup that's too salty. You know, you could add water to reduce the amount of salt. When you add air, the concentration of virus that's floating around drops substantially. And so we know that this is true. And we've seen it. We can model it, but we know it's true. Back before and this is true for bacteria as well as viruses. I mean, one of the treatments for tuberculosis before we had antibiotics was to go somewhere where it was at higher altitude, so the air was thinner, and to be in outdoors in the fresh air and in the fresh air and sunlight. And that actually was a treatment for tuberculosis that people would actually improve when they were put in that kind of a setting. And we've known this for a long time. You could sort of imagine like the crowded tenements of New York City. I'm just picking New York City, no offense, New York.
Right.
But it's a stereotype that for, you know, 1905 and the Chicago stockyards and all of that. So when people are jammed together, they spread their diseases more. And this is also true for any animals. You know, there's just more sharing going on. So dilution is the answer to why you don't worry about virus coming in. It also, in terms of the lawn or other things, you don't get a pure virus particle. You get a droplet or a micro droplet, but the virus dries out really quickly. So if it isn't in a moist place, it basically dries out and is no longer infectious. So that's another reason. So keeping the air, if it lands on a piece of fabric, for example, a cloth, paper, it doesn't last very long. It dries out. If it lands on, say, a piece of plastic, it lasts longer because the plastic isn't leaching away the moisture the way fabric or paper do. So this is an interesting little tidbit. But we also know that the bigger your exposure, the more virus you breathe in, the more likely you are to get sick because your immune system has a first line of defense. But imagine you've got a perimeter, you've got maybe 16 guards around a football field, right? And let's suppose one guy tries to get into the center of the football field. Good bet the 16 guards are going to be able to prevent him from getting to the center of the football field. Very good bet. On the other hand, if you've got 16 guards and 200 people try to get into the center of the football field, a lot of them are going to.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's dilution and concentration that drive these infections.
Okay. I had gone to an ENT doctor, and his window was open and back in May, and I was, "You have a window open?" And he said this to me, and I made him repeat it twice. And his thing was, the answer to pollution is dilution.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
I know. Oh, the solution to pollution is dilution.
Right. It's very, very basic microbiology. And I will add a couple more hints that I've given to several patients, and we know from some of the earlier studies, and there's one particular place in China that the study came out, and it was a tight little Chinese restaurant in China, and in Wuhan, and they had a group of, and they had an air conditioner on one wall. And so, you know, the air conditioner is blowing air into the room. And the people who were downwind from the infected table all got sick. The people who were lateral to the air conditioner, so they weren't part of that stream, they were basically in the corners of the room. So even though they were the same distance away, that air current made all of the difference. Now, that's one of the things that you can use when you're, if you are in a, let's say you're trying to be socially distanced and have an outdoor meal, but it's cold. And I don't, at this point, at least in my state, we do not mix households. We are really, really not supposed to do that. And the reason is you're already, I mean, if somebody in your household gets it, you're going to be exposed. But you don't need to make it more risky by going out and associating with people who aren't in your household that you aren't already exposed to. But if you are in a setting where there's any kind of encounter, having a fan, like one of those little menopause fans that used to be all the rage. Right. I had one nurse who worked for me. She had terrible hot flashes, and she had a little spray bottle with a fan on it. And she would just sit there and spray herself and run the fan and take deep breaths, you know, when she was going through one of the things, poor thing. But a little fan, I bought a little fan at the hardware store that fits around my neck, and I feel really embarrassed using it, so I've only used it a few times. But when I went to the swap meet, back when I went to the swap meet in the summer, I used it. And I just wore it around my neck. And anybody who saw it probably thought that I was having hot flashes, which is fine with me. But actually what I was doing was I was blowing their air back at them. And I was wearing a mask. Okay. But I was like, okay, I want to be in a negative air zone. So I'm going to blow air away from me. But why not, if you're at a table, blow air across? So for example, think of a square table. You're sitting at north. I'm sitting at south. We're going to put a fan and blow air from west to east. So your air is going to hit the sidewall. My air is going to hit the sidewall. And we're not going to have much blending. So we will be increasing the dilution.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, same principle as you know, the shields that you see, the plexiglass shields. The stuff is heavier than air, so it tends to float and eventually drop, but it doesn't rise. So under most circumstances, just that plexiglass screen, is anything coming out of their mouth or yours is not going to process, because it's not going to do a high jump over the plexiglass.
Right, because it goes down, right?
Right. And we know. Yeah, I mean, we have got the data now. We've done the experiment of, you know, do these measures work? Do they limit spread? Yeah, they do. And now in my state, or excuse me, in my county, I don't have data for my state, but in my county, we're up to 68% of the cases are household. That's basically all that's left, because we've done everything we can do in public, or almost everything. I mean, please wear a mask, people. But when you do all of those things, the only way left to get it is to get it from someone that you live with.
Yeah. And at this time
unless
of year,
you're a doctor,
here
a nurse, or
on the East Coast, it's cold and everybody's back in their rooms again in apartments. Like you said, in New York, everybody's crowded in.
Well, you have any heaters that blow air? If you have any heaters that blow air, and by the way, this is not yet in short supply because people have not figured this out. But if you have a heater that has a blower on it, do what I said, put it sideways.
Okay. I have forced hot air, so it only comes from the ceiling. But I think, and
yes.
I open my windows all the time. I'm big on that.
You know,
so
air travel's down. I think that we're just going to have to burn more energy this winter and pay a bigger electric bill in order to get this going. But it's probably going to be a wash in terms of the carbon, because nobody is flying, and nobody is going on cruises. And those are two of the most polluting things that we're not doing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
So I won't feel like such an eco-criminal.
Well, again, as always, I love your analogy, so I will keep that in my head, and my friend and I will have this discussion tomorrow. I will inform her of what you said. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Bye-bye. I want to talk just briefly about HEPA filters, because those do work and they are available. They're not that hard to find. I don't think you need to buy the one that has the UVC. I think you can get by with one that doesn't have ultraviolet. I'm not sure that that's worth the extra $100. But those HEPA filters are basically N95 masks, and we know that that works because we haven't got nearly as many sick doctors and nurses as we would if those puppies didn't work. So we've done that experiment too. Let's go to, in the last 6 minutes, I can do this quick email. This is from Maria in Des Plaines, which I will have to look up. Eating for your blood type. Dear Dr. Don, I would love your opinion about eating for your blood type. My partner and I have both been eating a vegan diet for the last 18 months, and while I seem to thrive on it, she is not. She has lost considerable muscle mass and feels like she's aging, as in skin sagging more than it should be. I happen to know that I'm A positive, which is supported by a vegan diet, but considering her preferences for hardcore exercise and that she was at her best on paleo a few years ago, we can safely guess that she is type O. So, no, actually, we can't. And I want to talk to you a little bit about this blood type diet. There's a guy named Peter D'Adamo who has written books about it. It just isn't true. And it was all based on a study that was published a long time ago that looked at biomarkers. So the idea was they looked at body mass index, blood pressure, cholesterol, and insulin, and they followed their diets for a period of a month. And based on the diet, each person was classified as tending to follow a blood type diet for either A, O, or B. There were lots of differences in biomarkers between the groups, but when they looked at the blood types, the people who seemed to be doing well on whatever diet they were eating, basically there was no evidence that it was better. And so the type of evidence you're suggesting or talking about really, to me, looks like with the fact that your partner needs protein. And it's more about her, it's not her blood type, and I don't think you can infer that she is type O. I think it has to do with the fact that in order for her to maintain her muscle mass, she has to consume muscles, which is what meat is. Some people are able to be fine on a vegan diet. It has a lot to do with your digestive system, and it has a lot to do with your genes, but not the genes that determine your blood type. And there have been numerous studies that failed to find a correlation. There really isn't any reason to believe that this is why. I'm not arguing with your facts. My philosophy is the patient is always giving me their truth as they see it. But I might not necessarily agree with their interpretation. And I think that's one of these situations. I suspect that if your partner were to consume large amounts of vegan protein powder, she might be able to overcome this. And I'd encourage you to try that experiment first, since, as we've already talked about this, it might be hard for your relationship if she goes back to eating meat. She might not smell as good to you, and for whatever reason, this does seem to be a thing. So let's just a variety of concentrated vegetarian proteins, see if that works. If it doesn't, then I'm afraid we're looking at meat here. If she wants to thrive, sometimes by hyperalimentation, by giving a whole bunch of a vitamin, you can make a gene that isn't working too well work a little bit better. A good analogy, the vitamin D receptor. If you've got a vitamin D receptor that is mutated, taking higher doses of vitamin D will allow the receptor to be stimulated a high enough percentage of the time that you maintain your bone mass and all the other wonderful things that vitamin D does. So The clock on the clubhouse wall tells me that it is time for me to thank you for listening and to invite you back next week for more Q&A on Ask Dr. Dawn. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.